This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
I just love the idea of male enhancement tourism.
Come for the seafood, stay for the penis enhancement.
That was a crushing detail about how he can no longer hold it in his hand. I mean,
right.
What can he hold it with?
A tweezer?
Yeah.
and a magnifying glass? Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
And I'm Matt Taibbi, and this is week three of Useful Idiots Unchained, Useful Idiots Judgment Day, Useful Idiots Returns.
Useful Idiot European Vacation.
Useful Idiots Fury Road. We're doing yet another episode of the new Useful Idiots, and
yet another one. He sounds so excited.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to convey the maximum excitement.
Yeah.
Lots to get to. We have an interesting guest this week, but we have some other announcements we have to get to before get to the show.
And just so people know, that will be a bonus premium content. That's premium content because, again, you guys get the full podcast, the full video for free.
I think we're going to start mixing this a little bit with substance abuse. We haven't quite figured out the formula.
Right. It's called Substack abuse.
Right, yes.
This will be the Substack abuse. Substack stance, which you have a very strong one. I mean, that's what last episode was about, our Substack stance. And our hot take was don't try. I mean, you can try to blackmail Substack into driving people off the site, but it just may not work.
You might get a Streisand effect, and you might see more Substack subscribers, which is what nobody wants, apparently. So anyway, progressing.
Progressing. So we have an RSS feed, and guess what, guys? Everything old is new again. So it's just the same RSS feed for the podcast as we had before. If you've unsubscribed, resubscribe. We will soon have a vanity URL where it's like usefulidiots, youtube.com/usefulidiots. But for now, you can find everything on Substack. You can subscribe to the RSS feed as you would any other podcast. And again, if you were already subscribed to us, then you don't have to resubscribe. Thanks for this wonderful ride. We still have some growing pains. But you know what? That's the price of freedom and independence. Useful Idiots decolonized.
This is the post-colonial period of Useful Idiots.
Subaltern. Everything is at usefulidiots.substack.com. If you're ever, you feel unmoored, rudderless, just go there.
Yeah, and the site is also going to be now a repository for things like updates about guests of the show, other things that we might talk about.
More interaction, suggestions for books that you want us to read passages of, and whenever there's a useful bump, which is when, or idiot bump, which is when one of our guests is in the news and we claim credit for it.
After we had Jesse Singel and Katie Herzog on the show, immediately they plunged into yet another insane Twitter controversy. GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Discrimination, put Jesse on their list, basically their shit list, that included people like Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. And, he was upset about it, obviously, and tweeted about it. But then Dan Savage, the sort of famed LGBTQ columnist from The Stranger and the inventor of the neologism Santorum, he did something which people basically don't do on Twitter anymore, which is he stood up for an unpopular person. And within about 8 seconds, he was trending on Twitter in the United States because everybody wanted you to know how much not only he sucks now, but how much he's always sucked.
Yeah.
And that became a whole thing. And clearly it's our fault.
All press is good press, right? I don't care what that you say about me as long as you spell my name right. I mean, it would have been nice if they'd spelled Jesse's first name. They just wrote single because I guess they were in a mad rush.
Right.
To warn people.
Yeah. Maybe they were confusing him with some other single that we don't know about. Ezekiel single.
Yeah. Ezekiel single.
Right.
Or yeah.
Jedediah single.
Yeah. Methuselah single.
Methuselah. All right, so a lot to get to. We should get to the four food groups.
Yeah.
Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that weird? I think you're up first.
Yeah, I got the Democrats suck. So this is a great clip. This is from Mehdi Hasan has a show on Peacock now, and he interviewed Cedric Richmond.
And there are a lot of good things in legislation, but also some questionable things. I want to talk about one of those. Today's the 11th anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. As you say, the rescue plan expands subsidies for ACA plans, making premiums much cheaper for many families. That's a good thing. But it could also spend an estimated $35 billion fully covering COBRA for around 2 million unemployed people for just 6 months. How is that a good use of that money? $35 billion subsidizing insurance companies for 6 months. Wouldn't that money be better invested towards building universal health care in this country?
Well, clearly you have health insurance right now. But the question is, you ought to pose that to people who have lost their job through no fault of their own, that has lost their health insurance and they need a bridge so that they stay with insurance, so that they can get that checkup and detect cancer early. It's very easy for people to make judgment calls when they're not in other people's shoes, and I won't do that. I won't put a price on lives. I won't put a price
on... Hold on.
Let me finish.
Okay.
No, but I'm not going to put a price tag on a woman finding out that she has early stages of breast cancer so that we can beat it. I mean, look, did we rise to the moment? Yes. Did we spend $1.9 trillion? We did. You know why? Because there was $1.9 trillion worth of problems in this country that we were trying to fix.
Yes. So with respect, I just need to push back a little bit. I'm in favor of you spending $1.9 trillion. I'd have gone higher. I'm very happy that you're spending lots of money. And as for the money on healthcare, it's not that I don't want you to spend $35 billion on healthcare. I'm in favor of universal healthcare. And when you say there's no price tag on healthcare, the problem is the president, Joe Biden, told us there is. He says we can't afford Medicare for all. I'm saying if you can afford $35 billion to give to COBRA, which is a very inefficient, overpriced way of giving people healthcare, why not spend that money on a universal healthcare system that helps everyone, not just insurance companies?
Well, remember, this is a response to a pandemic. If we didn't have COVID-19, you wouldn't see us doing that COBRA appropriation. So remember, we're probably saying close to the same thing. But remember, this is in response to people losing their jobs through no fault of their own.
I saw you wince at the suggestion that we should be spending it on universal health care.
I'm wincing because MSNBC spent the entirety of 2019
of course,
and 20 arguing the exact opposite.
Yes. To be fair to Mehdi Hasan, though, he was not there at that point, and he has always been on that side of the issue.
Sure.
But yes, and what's it? But you're right that like Andrea Mitchell, for instance, saw the value in Medicare for All once Sanders was out of the race.
Right.
I'll give her credit for that totally organic evolution. First of all, Cedric Richmond is the former Louisiana representative who's a major oil and energy guy. And I don't know if you remember this, but this actually can be our new feature, Woke Wash of the Week. Weekly woke washing. The Sunrise Movement was upset that he was named to the Biden administration. So I tweeted, I hope the New York Times calls out Mehdi Hasan for picking a fight with the most influential black staffer in the White House, right? Jonathan Martin at the New York Times. So Sunrise Movement tweeted out or released a statement saying Cedric Richmond hire is betrayal due to big oil ties and silence on pollution in his district. And Jonathan Martin of the New York Times, a reporter, tweets 21 preview, picking a fight right from the start with the most influential black staffer in the White House who represented an energy heavy district. So that's Martin just totally carrying water for the Biden administration and for Cedric Richmond in the most woke washy way ever, basically being like,
to be fair, he did it in the past. He didn't do it this week.
But it is his prediction, right? So
right.
That's going to be the 21
it's
preview.
It's come to pass. Yeah.
It's come to pass. And I wonder if he stands by this. I mean, I think it's a pretty embarrassing attempt to weaponize identity politics, obviously, in order to protect someone whose policies are obviously bad for black people, because that's how environmental racism works. You know, then you have, of course, the famous Hillary Clinton will breaking up the banks and racism. And as you know more than I do, Matt, you know, the housing crisis was quite racialized.
Right, yeah, it was disproportionately the mortgage-backed securities thing was, it was basically a modern version of old sort of racial real estate scams.
Yeah.
And they had all these horrible cases, like with, you know, Wells Fargo selling what they called ghetto loans and all that.
Yeah, we got to be vigilant. This is going to happen all the time. The way that some people will try to, and Jonathan Martin's white, so A+ for the allyship, but people are definitely trying to either cudgel the left through this and or protect people, cover for them, shill for them, shill for those who shill themselves. It's a shilling alliance.
I do find it interesting, though, that Mehdi and there is this new kind of direction of criticism that's kind of coming from the progressive left that you wouldn't have seen on corporate TV before. Not really sure what that's about. Like, you know, it's either sincere or it's, you know, it's a new form of propaganda that I haven't figured out yet. Because there is never going to be, at least not anytime soon, I don't think, a universal healthcare program, unless the Democratic Party foregoes its reliance upon those donors. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think Mehdi is sincere in that. I mean, I disagree with him on certain things, but I think he's sincere in this. The thing I think it could be is this kind of release valve, MSNBC, like pandering just enough so that they don't look like totally like the anti-single payer, anti-Medicare all apparatus.
Pro Park Avenue.
That they are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Park Avenue adjacent.
I don't live on Park Avenue, but I live pretty close.
You know how I got there? I work my butt. That's Stephanie Ruhle, of course, who was mad that Biden, I mean, let the guy pander when he said that the race was a race between Scranton and Park Avenue. The guy doesn't live in Scranton. Yes, he's from there. I mean, to be fair, Trump is from Queens, a very fancy part, Jamaica State's of Queens. But if you're going to do, you know, the origins, then you got to compare Scranton to Jamaica State's. Also, this is the guy. Let him say that, because obviously the guy behind closed doors who said nothing would fundamentally change. Stephanie, you're fine. You're going to be fine. Nothing would fundamentally change.
It was just funny that they were objecting to his fake pandering.
Exactly. Like they were objecting. Like she's so triggered by it and so entitled by it that she doesn't even get that this is just a talking point. And the thing he said behind closed doors, which is obviously the honest thing, is that nothing would fundamentally change. Right. I wonder if they called her. They were like, Stephanie, what are you doing? Obviously, this isn't what the race is about.
No,
Let us say that.
Not to digress too much, because we can't spend too much time on this. But I mean, I think a big theme of the 2020 primary race, there were a lot of people indulging in kind of populist themes. But that was very frowned upon by the party. Like there was a lot of pushback to that. And that's where you got that, you know, the Chris Matthews, they're going to line me up in Central Park and shoot me because it's like
Stop
Cuba.
Stop getting my hopes up. Yeah.
I've definitely noticed that there's a change in some of that in terms of the media ever since
Bernie
Sanders has been toppled.
Right.
So who knows what that means.
But, yeah. The talking points are like so transparent. Like people have lost their jobs through no fault of their own. What is that even? What, like usually when there isn't a pandemic, people are a bunch of ne'er-do-wells are the only people who lose their job. I mean, anyway, not putting a price tag on healthcare. You are, obviously. And this, again, he's working for the administration that said that he would veto a Medicare for All bill. Biden said that. So don't pretend that, you know, this is something that you guys want. Anyway, Cedric Richmond is an interesting character. And it's very weird. His position is very amorphous. It's basically to be a talking head, but also to hire someone to create this like white conservative outreach branch for Biden, because the optics of hiring a white conservative or a white liberal even to do that would be problematic. So Biden is using him as the black liaison
for white conservative outreach.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't even wrap my head around how ridiculous all that is. It's amazing.
We discovered that on the Katie Halper show in real time. Trevor Beaulieu from Champagne Sharks, who's a lawyer and a podcast host, obviously, who's very good at breaking things, like getting to the, basically just has that lawyerly skill of like breaking things down in real time, figured that out.
All right. Republicans suck. As is often the case with this show, we end up having to kind of go with sort of old standbys for Republicans suck when the party sort of lapses into its familiar old villainous habits.
Right.
That's usually the best material that we have. We had a bunch of mass shootings recently. The Republicans kind of rolled out the playbook they've been using for God, how many years now with this stuff? At least since the mid-80s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Since the James Huberty McDonald's shooting. I always wonder what he ordered.
What was that one?
That was the guy when the guy went into McDonald's and he shot like 23 people. And then like the big mystery was, what did he order? Like, I can't remember.
And no one ever found out?
I don't think we ever found out.
Well, maybe he had PTSD from living with the name Huberty.
Maybe.
What if it was actually like adolescence or something? Or Hetestes dissension.
Oh, I see. Because it sounds like puberty.
Yeah.
So this week, Ted Cruz talking.
Oh my God.
To Sean Hannity. So this is like a matter antimatter, just sort of vortex of awesomeness already.
Yeah. Also, what's up with Ted Cruz's increasingly long hair and facial hair? He's just a hideous person.
He's going for something. I think it's funny. He's going for some kind of 60s like.
I know.
Bob Dylan, you know, man, like wise old man in a cave thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he was in Arthur Miller's play, The Crucible. I think that he really betrays his.
And he was the Zodiac killer who probably wants to.
Wait, what do you mean he was the Zodiac killer?
You don't know about Ted Cruz being the Zodiac killer?
No.
So this was a rumor. This was a rumor that went around during the 2016 campaign. Trump fed into it, among others.
And his dad could kill JFK.
Right. No, but there was a separate rumor about him being the Zodiac killer. It got so much traction that they actually asked his wife, is your husband the Zodiac killer? Now, Ted Cruz was born 2 years after the killings ended. So it was ridiculous to begin with. But she
hardworking, industrious. Yeah.
His wife gave what they call a non-denial denial. She's like, you know, I've known him my whole life and I know exactly what kind of person he is. Like, she didn't say no. So it turned into this whole thing. Anyway.
Do you remember when he liked a porn video? Do you remember that? Right after some like anti-masturbation speech, he liked some porn video that was an incest-themed one. To be fair, no, it was stepmother, so it's not incest. So forget that.
That's not incest.
It's not, you're right. But still, it's a very common porn trope. Well, fine, but it's not exactly. I mean, look, I don't know what the most family values ish porn genre would be, but it's probably not any kind of even step relationship. Can you imagine though that he survived that? How did he survive that? He's so reactionary because I know that.
Because everybody watches stepmother porn videos.
Well, I mean, okay, I don't know if I can stand behind that. I don't have the stats. Doesn't resonate with me, but obviously necrophilia would be my thing of choice.
Right, yes.
Just kidding. I don't think that even, does that even exist?
Probably.
Yeah. And then, of course, what was it? His dad killed JFK? Is that, did Trump make that up?
Trump asked him about that. And reporters asked him about that after Trump did, which was awesome,
amazing.
Too.
Amazing, yeah.
Cruz needed to win that in order to stay in the race, and he didn't. He was desperately trying to, like, get some traction in the race, and the reporters were asking him, are you the Zodiac killer, and did your dad kill JFK? He was like losing his mind with frustration. It was funny.
Remember also, God, there's so much. Remember he elbowed his wife in the face?
Nice. Excellent.
And then look at her face. It's so terrible. And then he reached.
That's kind of a hockey check.
Yeah. Okay, watch again. There it is.
Yeah.
It's fist and elbow.
When you have a puck in the corner there, you just got to use every part of your body to try
totally,
to.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
All right, so Ted Cruz is on Sean Hannity this week and has this exchange.
Senator, thank you for standing up for our Constitution and the Second Amendment, because apparently many are not tonight, and Joe Biden's threatening executive action.
Well, Sean, that's exactly right. And the modern day left is more and more extreme. They have this bizarre antipathy to God and to prayer. So anytime, look, all of us have had people who've lost loved ones. And then the first thing you do when someone has lost a loved one is you reach out and say, hey, I'm lifting you up in prayer. I'm praying for you, your family.
Lift him.
I know you're hurting.
Yeah, what the hell is that?
Ted Cruz is a guy who, when he wants to, speaks the King's English, right? Like he's very precise in his language, but then in passages, in moments like this, he'll drop the G and say, lift him, just to point that out. Anyway, go ahead.
How dare you believe there's an omnipotent God who could actually love you and care for you? But more broadly than that, we see this cynical pattern whenever there is a mass murder. And I got to say, we have had way too many of these mass murders. Look, I've represented Texas in the Senate for 9 years now. I have been Santa Fe High School. Santa Fe is less than an hour away from my home. I was down in Santa Fe High School within an hour of that shooting. It was horrific. The crazed madman who murdered those kids. El Paso, the crazed racist bigot who murdered the people at that Walmart. I was there for that. Dallas, when five police officers were murdered by a radical leftist. I was there for that. And I got to tell you, Sutherland Springs, the worst
city in the U.S.
I was going to say,
he was the Zodiac killer.
Small town outside of San Antonio. I was there the day after the shooting. In that sanctuary, I saw with my own eyes the blood and shattered glass and the agony and the incredible love of that community. There have been too damn many of these, and we need to stop them. But the Democrats' proposal every time is always the same, which is take away guns from law-abiding citizens.
Two things about this that I think are hilarious. First is what you already caught on to, which is basically it's like sympathy for the devil. It's like every bad thing that happened, I was there. You know what I mean? Like, you know, when they shot the Kennedys and, you know, when my dad
shot the Kennedys.
Yeah, exactly. When Anastasia screamed in vain, killed the Tsar and his ministers, I was there, you know? Exactly.
It's like wherever you find a dead body, that's where you can find Ted Cruz.
Yeah, wherever there's piles of bodies that are still sizzling from having automatic rifle rounds pumped into them, Ted Cruz was there. So that's funny because I think that was inadvertent. He was trying to say something and the structure came out all wrong. But the other thing is just the construction about it's cynical. It's just so cynical how the Democrats always shift to guns in this moment. Matt, if we could just see the graph. So as you can see, this is a chart of the donations from the National Rifle Association to the various parties. By the year 2020, I think if you actually look at it by percentage, it's above 98% of all NRA donations go to the Republican Party. So whenever any of these clowns opens their mouths about what we should do about gun violence issues, this is the only relevant data, which is where's the money going to?
Yeah, that should just go on in the, what's it called, Chiron? It should just go in the Chiron.
Yeah, exactly.
Right
it should
after.
Go in the Chiron. Yeah. Here's how much. Cruz, to be fair, is not among the top recipients of NRA money.
Probably because everyone hates him.
Or because in Texas, you don't have to spend money on the case, right? Yeah, exactly.
You don't need the lobbyists.
Right. But just the whole idea that it's, they're so cynical. They're proposing gun control measures. But we are paragons of virtue who are completely unaffected by the
lifting people up in prayer.
Ass loads of money that we're getting from the National Rifle Association.
Right.
And every time somebody murders, 10 million people for no reason, not only are we in favor of cutting funds for mental health care so that folks can walk the streets, but we also want them to be as heavily armed as possible at all times because that's just a great combination. It's like peanut butter and chocolate. You just want it to go together, right?
That is a good combination, the peanut butter and chocolate. But I got to say, I do like when they become totally like interdisciplinary scholars and of sociology every time there's a shooting. It's like, it's the culture. It's video games. Sometimes and then the gun people will say it's a mental health issue, even though they, of course, oppose measures to make that like mental health a screening issue.
Well, sometimes they do.
Do they do both?
Yeah, they have. They have actually proposed mental health screening issues. But more importantly, they're almost always in favor of cutting back money for mental health services, which is why. You have places like Cook County in Chicago where instead of having people institutionalized and being under treatment, they're walking the streets and they end up in the criminal justice system.
Right. Yeah.
What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
Okay. For Isn't That Weird? Well, look, I don't like to respond. I don't want to be too beholden to the comments and I'm not making a habit out of this, but people complained last week that there wasn't any penis content. Now, first of all,
I think it was more like one person complained
it was multiple people. It's not just at YouTube. There's Substack comments. There's Twitter. Matt, I got multiple complaints, but here's the thing. Shame on you because there were first I internalized it because I'm a woman and I was, my go-to was to apologize. Mm-hmm. But then I realized that, no, there were two penis references in the last show. One was when Matt said, when we were talking about the kid who got that bad haircut and was like punished with isolation, because that's what British schools apparently do when kids get bad haircuts or mm-hmm. wear earrings. And Matt was like, you know, maybe if he had like a penis shaved into his head. And I was like, yeah, we would, of course, have him on the show if that were the case. And then at the end of our interview with Katie Herzog, she mentioned that she was, what, she has a blog about her dog's balls and penis.
Right.
And joked about...
Well, she's thinking about cutting off the penis and leaving the balls, yeah.
Oh, right, right, right. But I didn't know that... I thought... I'm so dumb about that stuff that I thought that that was actually a real option. But they are right that there wasn't very... There was no penis-focused news.
Mm.
And that changes right now. So for my... Isn't that weird? There's actually a show, and I'm kind of afraid because I feel like we're going to... I'll try to pace myself with these because I feel like we can get good content like every week. So this is an article. The headline is Adoration with Dor, you know, the D-O-O-R. My man ended up in A&E after he got his penis stuck while we tried to have sex through the bedroom door.
I'll do a little work on this side. Well, you've got your side covered.
Are you saying...
So I was playing with him through the door hole, and I got so excited that I just said we should have sex right now through this door.
And it was fantastic, as it always is, until...
Babe, what's wrong?
I'm stuck.
Eric took so much of the ED medication that it caused extra swelling to happen.
It hurts.
The doorknob hole was not big enough for his penis in that state.
What do you mean you're stuck?
I don't know, but I'm definitely stuck in pain.
My penis was stuck in this door hole, and I've never been in more excruciating pain in my entire life.
Okay, so
I love the recreation.
It's, I know, like, it's a reenactment, but it's not with them. Like you saw, it's not with
right,
them.
Right, but it looks like a little bit, yeah.
An adventurous couple have revealed how they ended up in A&E after they attempted to have sex through their bedroom door. Eric's penis became completely stuck, as we know from the video, as he attempted to spice things up with a girlfriend of 2 years, Katie. Wow. Could have been me, guys. Could have happened to me as a Katie.
Yeah.
The couple who appear on TLC's Sex Sent Me to the ER, and that's the show we're obviously going to be getting a lot of material from moving forward, admit to having an active sex life starting each Sunday morning with a romp in the hay. After engaging in some hanky-panky, Katie decided to bribe her boyfriend into getting some chores done with the promise of a round two. However, Eric admitted he needed a break. It's really hard to keep up with Katie's amazing sex drive, he confessed. Unbeknownst to her, I had been taking some male enhancement medication. I had to make sure I was ready for the surprise later, so I had to take a little bit extra. As he awaited his reward, Eric went about fitting Katie's bedroom door. He said, I had to cut a really small hole because, of course, Katie has to have a vintage doorknob. As I was looking at the new doorknob hole, I had an amazing idea. Okay, so he had to cut. He was doing a favor, I guess, to her, right? Like, not a non-sexual thing. Eric proceeded to poke his now erect penis through the hole in the door, much to Katie's delight. So that was his idea. So he was actually doing something to the knob unrelated to having sex, right?
Right. Also, we got a good double entendre going on here for the British folk. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. As I was... Right, looking at the new doorknob hole, I had an amazing idea. Eric proceeded to poke
the light bulb just going off with this guy. He's having
That's
his
really
burst of
funny.
Inspiration. It's like
Eureka.
It's like Leo Szilard thinking up the nuclear chain reaction, right? It's that level of inspiration.
It's that level, yeah. Eric proceeded to poke his now erect penis through the hole in the door, much to Katie's delight. I was surprised by how turned on I was, she said. I was playing with him through the door hole, and I got so excited that I just said we should have sex right now through the door. However, the couple had to cut their romp short when Eric's penis became jammed in the hole. The hole being the doorknob hole. The erectile dysfunction medication had caused his penis to swell, making it too big for the space. My penis is stuck in the door hole, and I've never been in more excruciating pain in my entire life, Eric said. I was incredibly shocked at how large my penis had grown, and I knew I had taken way too much of the supplement. Katie added, when I saw my boyfriend's penis turning purple, I was just thinking he might just lose his penis. After trying to free his member with the help of butter, olive oil, shampoo, and lotion, Katie was forced to call the paramedics. I was so unbelievably embarrassed, Eric admitted as he explained to the paramedics how he had come to be in that position. They explained that the erectile dysfunction pill could last for hours and he would continue to swell, which could lead him to lose circulation and eventually his penis. The paramedics didn't want to risk cutting him out completely and potentially cutting off his penis, so instead cut away a section of the door so Eric could make it to the ER where they could remove it safely. So he went to the ER with a door, part of a door surrounding his penis.
Naturally.
Naturally, yeah. Mm-hmm. He was obviously so embarrassed that he shared this on television, and they did a reenactment. So I'm glad he got over that
trauma. Get some more followers and whatever it is, whatever social media.
He needed healing, yeah.
I mean, this is like the Darwin Award for people having sex. I mean...
Yeah, but he didn't learn his... I mean, maybe it would be if he'd lost the penis. I'm glad he didn't. I'm just saying if it was the Darwin Award. This is like bronze. The gold would have been losing the penis.
Right, yeah, right. This is a bronze medal of penis stupidity. I'm not sure what we can really add to that except don't.
Yeah, don't. Don't do it, guys. Yeah.
So that's definitely weird. So I have terrible, which is actually it's similar theme.
Similar
but worse.
Region, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this could have happened. Yeah, okay, so take it away.
This is worse. You can tell when a reporter is writing about something extremely unpleasant, but they're having a little too much fun with the pros. Yeah. 30,000 pounds or 30,000 euros for botched penis job could lead to new law case. Judges in Lisbon have ruled that a well-known plastic surgeon should pay one of his clients 30,000 euros for the botched job performed on enlarging the man's penis. As a result of the news, a second man has come forward to say that he too will be suing the surgeon as he has suffered a similar personal disaster. Rui Fernandez, 53. Anyway, elected to have surgery to increase the size of his penis in 2016. The real ordeal, as he described it, ended with an even smaller penis. One so small, in fact, that he says he can't hold it in his hand. This is terrible.
It's so terrible. Isn't that terrible?
Is the whole experience has completely ruined his sex life. He tells Correo de Mania that he hasn't managed to be with a woman since the operation. Rui Fernandez has only now found the courage to do something about the situation after learning that the surgeon has been condemned to pay damages of 30,000 pounds for a similar error.
This is an epidemic, and remember, there was another story about a guy who just failed to show up for his penis reattachment surgery.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, again, I don't know what's in these people's schedules. They must have very exciting lives to prioritize something over penis health. And you know what? This is like a Me Too, a penis surgery Me Too. It took one person comes forward and then emboldens other people to come forward, which is good. But there is an interesting philosophical question here, which is that, look, this is elective surgery, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what the malpractice standard is for this. And I don't know, how do we know he botched it as opposed to it was just an impossible situation to work with?
Well, if he used an axe, I'm going to assume that
he botched
it.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, right, yeah. There's a real industry in Lisbon when it comes to penis enhancement.
Mm-hmm.
And you see it's a tourism website.
Penis enlargement tourism?
So if you scroll down, about penis enlargement, the information is intended for general information only and should not be considered as medical advice on the part of healthtourism.com. Penis enlargement, at times referred to as male enhancement, relates to a variety of methods meant to increase erectile rigidity, girth, or length of the human penis. Human only, guys. Do not bring in your cow.
Right.
For this.
Or your three-toed sloth.
Procedures cover from manual workouts to stretching gadgets and surgical treatments.
Taper. I wouldn't bring a taper to this clinic either.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about those. Yeah. But maybe a tape measure. With reports of positive results and setbacks globally.
I just love the idea of combining tourism with this. Male enhancement tourism. Come to Lisbon.
Come for the seafood, stay for the penis enhancement.
Right. Right, exactly.
But you have to be circumcised, which is interesting and kind of problematic, I feel like. Can't you squeeze in a circumcision if you're making a penis bigger? Like, that's the line?
Yeah, that feels discriminatory to me. Anyway, it's bad, and look, that was a crushing detail about how he can no longer hold it in his hand. I mean,
right.
What can he hold it with?
A tweezer?
Yeah.
And a magnifying glass?
Just don't
do it. Don't put your dick in a door, and don't try to make it bigger, because it'll get smaller. Our next guest is a return guest. Matt Stoller is the director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project. He's the author of the Simon & Schuster book, Goliath, the 100-Year War Between Monopoly Power and Democracy, which Business Insider called one of the year's best books on how to rethink capitalism and improve the economy.
The reason we wanted to have Matt on this week in particular is because there are hearings in Congress this week that ostensibly are about the tech industry. So the House Energy and Commerce Committee is inviting people like Jack Dorsey, Mark Zuckerberg, and Sundar Pichai to Washington. And we've seen a bunch of these hearings already where they kind of bring all these CEOs to Washington and kind of yell at them about why haven't you stopped this and that. This is all taking place within this kind of meta discussion that's happening within the Democratic Party. Like, what do we do about speech? Matt Stoller is one of the few people who's sort of on the Democratic Party, within the world of Democratic Party aligned activists, who is looking at this from kind of like a traditionally liberal point of view, which says basically that you address these speech issues not by making these companies more concentrated and using it to clamp down on speech, but instead by like looking at their business model, which encourages stupid and defamatory and conspiratorial speech. It's kind of surveillance-based ad regimes that they all use. So he's kind of an expert in this stuff, and I think it's useful to get into because a lot of people, especially online, are thinking, well, there's only really one way to deal with like hate speech and fake news and other things. And actually, that stuff happens for a reason that's very connected to how these companies do business. And he's really a good person to talk about those issues. So without further ado, let's talk to Matt Stoller. Welcome to Useful Idiots, Matt Stoller, who is the director of research at the American Economic Liberties Project. Matt, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming back. We wanted to have you on for a couple of reasons. By the time this comes out, these hearings will be over, but there are hearings this week in the Energy and Commerce Committee that are about, the headline of it, the title is, Hearing on Disinformation Nation, Social Media's Role in Promoting Extremism and Misinformation. There's a big debate kind of going on within the Democratic aligned activist world and in politics about approaches to dealing with problems in the speech world. And I was wondering if you could sort of outline what that debate is, and then we can talk about what your thoughts are about that. Because the fashionable thing currently is what's going to happen tomorrow, which is they're going to bring all these CEOs in, yell at them, and demand that they clamp down on stuff. But it's not a very nuanced look at the bigger problem in the industry, seems to me. But if you could explain it probably better than me.
That's a good explanation. I mean, I don't know why you even had me on. I'm a fraud. There's sort of it's inchoate, but there's like two sides, and one is, you know, for a long time, there've been a bunch of people who've been saying, hey, these firms are really powerful. I say a long time, but 5 to 10 years. This is kind of the anti-monopoly wing. Google and Facebook break them up, regulate them. They're really powerful and big, and that's scary. And that really comes from like there's a number of committees in Congress. So without getting too deep, there's like the antitrust subcommittee is the one that's been like, hey, these firms are really powerful and they're picking and choosing winners. Usually, like, it's about, they talk about small business, but the issue with speech is the same thing. And then the other kind of side, which is, I think, noisier and has more of the like MSNBC, CNN vibe, is the disinformation, misinformation world. This is kind of the Russiagate people, the like, the we don't like that Trump can speak type of people. And what their argument is effectively that these firms haven't sufficiently curated their platforms to present what they think is a legitimate form of public debate. And they're thinking, well, we need to figure out how to get them to filter differently and organize discourse differently. It's kind of like, you know, the Facebook, like Mark Zuckerberg created their oversight board, which is essentially the Supreme Court for content.
Right.
And people that are kind of saying the oversight board, no, keep Trump off of Facebook. And they kind of accept ideologically, they just accept the dominance of these firms. And they're just kind of like, what's the best way for these firms to organize discourse?
Right. So it's like they want to preserve, or they either want to, or they're conceding the inevitability of these firms sort of staying in the form that they're in. And therefore, making that concession, they kind of want to direct that power in a direction that they'd like better. Is it an accurate summation of what
that's saying? Right. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons for that. Some of them are kind of like neoliberal. A lot of the law professors are like, oh, this is just the way of technology, and you know, this is more efficient, and therefore the question is, how do you manage these large platforms, which are just fun? They're just inevitable. This is just what happens. And then there's actually like socialists who think that too, who are just kind of like, well, the internet killed newspapers. The internet does all of these things. So we have to figure out. And also there's a bunch of them that never liked commercial press in the first place. You know, Victor Picard and a lot of well-meaning people who are like, we never liked, you know, advertising models to begin with. We think everything should be like the BBC. And so those are the kind of the two groups that accept the inevitability thesis. And it's really deep rooted in political philosophy. It's not just a simple disagreement. And then there's people like us who are like, no, actually technology is deployed according to law and regulation, and the specific regulatory model that we have, the business structures of these firms, the way they make money from advertising, those are specific policy choices, and we can make different ones if we want.
And it also seems like one of those groups, I mean, some may identify as socialists, but that there's this just general group of, we oppose hate speech and white supremacy, and so we have to make these companies that are evil stop being evil and decide, give them moral authority and content moderation authority, which is kind of a, you know, inherent contradiction / wishful thinking / inconsistent paradox.
I think that's right. And I don't mean to mischaracterize socialism. The socialism there's a lot of different people who have a lot of different points of view. When I mean to mischaracterize socialism, you'll know it.
Yeah. But you're saying like leftists, right? Leftists, not liberals, not neoliberals, not even liberals, but people who are really would identify as left.
Yeah. And I think there's a part of the socialist world that's like, what we really want is egalitarianism in the form of a giant HR compliance department that tells everyone to be tolerant, right? And then there are most people who are like, no, I just don't like Wall Street and I want people to be equal and everyone should have a little bit of ownership over something. And they both call themselves socialists.
Sure,
They're just different. These are more statists, people that are kind of centralizers. And that's really the distinction. It's the centralizers versus the decentralizers. That's on the right, left, and center.
But no, I do think like the more frustrating group is, because obviously there are neoliberals who want this to happen, and that's not as like, to me at least, surprising. But I do think it's very short-sighted and ahistorical when you have people who are calling for content moderation, and from these corporations, which they know aren't good, but they somehow think will become good. And I have heard this weird argument that, well, the left is already censored, so who cares if they censor the right? That's good. I don't know if you've heard that, but it's pretty, it's a weird one.
There's a certain victim complex type in politics, which is not isolated to the left or the right.
Not at all.
Anyway, we can get back to.
But this is all sensitive. I mean, that's the thing. It's like when you boil, I tried to use words to be like, oh, they want to organize discourse in different. That's a nice way of saying they want people to censor on their behalf, right? And that's like, and censorship happens in a number of different ways. One way to censor is just to say this content can't travel, right? We're just going to block the content. The other way is to arrange financing resources so that only people who say certain things can make money from it. And, you know, advertising is really complicated. But really, if you go back to the early 1800s, the foundation of the post office, the foundation of kind of the modern, or not of newspaper systems, advertising was a way of financing newspapers and protecting them from the state, right? And that's so important because the way that Americans have always thought about the media is that the media should be a check on the powerful and should be a check on the state. And you need a financing system that arranges that. And advertising and subscriptions and then neutral types of subsidies like the creation of the post office and subsidization of the development of the internet, these kind of structural subsidies, that's the traditional way that we have regulated the discourse. And then in sort of the 20th century, the First Amendment took a central position. But traditionally, like before that, we thought about speech in terms of network systems and structures. And the post office was a lot more important in the 19th century than the First Amendment was.
Well, this gets to something that I think is important in this debate, which is the structural reasons why a lot of the things that people complain about on these platforms happen. It feels to me like a lot of the critics who want these companies to kind of just censor more, some of that comes from a lack of understanding of why these problems happen in the first place. There's a belief, I think, that it's an organic thing that's springing up out of the population and we just have to clamp down on it. But there's another way of looking at it, which is that this is the inevitable result of a certain kind of economic strategy and set of incentives that dominates these companies. And you've made this argument, I know, and the American Economic Liberties Project talked about there's a reason why taking Trump off Twitter isn't going to fix the problem because you're not fixing those incentives. Can you talk about what those incentives are and why they cause the problems?
Yeah, so Google and Facebook, I'll talk about Twitter slightly. It's a slightly different problem, but Google and Facebook are core internet infrastructure. So they have trackers all over the web and they're tracking you even when you're not on Google and Facebook. They track you on your apps. They have huge dossiers of data on you. And then they also show ads to you when you're not on their sites. Like Facebook and Google both are large advertising systems. And they also control software that advertisers use and publishers use. So, and they are communication networks. Now, what this means is that they are interested in keeping you using their services, and they are interested in collecting lots of data so that they can sell you advertising. Google and Facebook, they sell ads, right? They collect lots of information on you and they sell ads. And ads are valuable for two reasons. One, you're looking at them. And two, if they know who you are and they know information about you, then they can make the ad more valuable. Like, a random ad space isn't worth very much that you're showing to some undefined person. An ad space you're showing to a 55-year-old man who's thinking of buying a luxury car, somebody will pay a lot for that ad space, right? And or if you know who that person is and you know that that person has actually been browsing luxury car websites and reading the Wall Street Journal, about how best to like liquidate their portfolio or something to buy a luxury item, that ad space is super valuable. Right. So knowing a lot about the person and what they're doing makes advertising valuable. And Google and Facebook want to sell that advertising, particularly on their properties where they get to keep 100% of the profits. If Google, you know, sells an ad on YouTube, they get to keep the money. Facebook sells an ad on Instagram or Facebook, they get to keep the money. So their goal is to keep you using their sites and to collect information on you. To do that, they have all sorts of psychological tricks that they use. Engagement is the sort of the way that they talk about it. But it's like if you go and you look for something on YouTube, they're going to send you something that's a little bit more extreme. And it's not necessarily just political. It's like if you look at stuff that's like, here's how to become a vegetarian, they'll say, well, how about becoming a vegan, right? Or if you look at stuff that's like scared of whether this vaccine, I want to find safety data on this vaccine, eventually they'll sort of move you to like serious anti-vax world, right? That's what will show up in your feeds. And that's just to sell advertising. The question that we have to ask is not whether you should block crazy people from saying things. Like Alex Jones, for example, is a crazy person or an entertainer, but he says things that I don't particularly like or agree with. The question, though, isn't whether Alex Jones should have a platform. We've always allowed people on go to the corner of the street and say whatever they want, or to write pamphlets or whatever. The question is, should YouTube have recommended Alex Jones 15 billion times through its algorithms so that YouTube could make money selling ads? That's a different question than censorship.
And conversely, not recommended other material
right.
that might discourage you from believing Alex Jones.
That's exactly right. And it's not just that they want to create more inventory so they can sell ads. It's also the kinds of ads they're selling. So you can sell an ad based on trust, like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whoever it is. They have an audience, and people, they built that audience by investing in content, and then they sell ads to that audience, and the advertiser knows where that advertising is going, and it's based on trust, okay? The alternative model, which we have now, is simply based on clickbait. It's just generate as many impressions as possible, and then sell those impressions wherever, you know, wherever the person is on the web. And that creates a kind of journalism which is designed to get clicks, or not even journalism. It's just you're creating content just to get engagement and not actually to build trust. So what this business model does, we call it surveillance advertising, but it's an infrastructure player, a communications player, manipulating you so that they could put content, engaged content in front of you. What that does is it gets you to, it incentivizes a low trust form of content production. It both kills trusted content producers, AKA local newspapers, right? Because you no longer need to be able to put in advertising in the Pittsburgh, you know, Gazette, whatever it is. You can just geo-target those people through all of these other, you know, through Google and Facebook. And that content is not any, you know, people are going to click on that or they're not. You know, you can get some Eastern European to falsify stories, and people will click on that, right? So it kills legitimate newspapers, and it creates an incentive for low trust content, fraudulent content, defamatory content, whatever it is that will keep you engaged and is often fraudulent. And this hits really local newspapers and niche newspapers the most. So Black-owned newspapers, and also newspapers having to do with like hobbies. It also affects political dialogue, but the actual issue is more about niche audiences themselves and the kind of low trust content that we're encouraging with our policy framework versus what we used to do, which we would encourage higher trust forms of content.
I had a friend who basically like drew me a diagram of his perception of how this works. Like if you can imagine like a circle, that's the set of all your attention, right? All the things that you're interested in. And then Facebook will identify a circle inside that circle, which is all the things that you're super interested in that are likely to engage you for an incredibly long time. They will push you towards that inner circle. They don't want you moving out of that little bubble at all. Right. They want you to be engaged in the pure heroin of whatever it is that stimulates right. you the most and keeps you engaged the most, which does a couple of things. Number one, it prevents you from using the part of your mind that exercises judgment or is exposed to different kinds of ideas. And it totally devalues what you were talking about, the business model that, like, say, the old Pittsburgh Post-Gazette built up, which was, you know, you spend decades building up a trust with your audience, and that's the business model, right? Like, you trust us, you're going to trust our advertisers, but you don't need that anymore with this. Like, that business model is now useless, because what's most important is just keeping you fixated. So it not only, like, creates an incredibly stupid, conspiratorial, negative form of content, or highlights it, but it devalues that other kind of content and makes a worse kind of consumer at the same time.
Yeah.
We should also say that it's not as if the New York Times and Washington Post should be trusted either, but it is still a different model.
Well, they're also shifting now too. Yeah. That's a thing. Like they're changing their business model in this direction, but That's a different question.
So everything was perfect before.
Yeah, of course.
We didn't go to war in Iraq.
Right, exactly.
This was pushed by Judy Miller. That didn't happen. Everything is good. No, if you want to go back, I mean, really, you should go back to the 96 Telecom Act and consolidation. But I actually want to offer one other problem that these firms cause, right? This business model. Because we all think, oh, I'm not susceptible to propaganda or whatever they're doing, right? And that's true. But we've all, maybe, probably not, it's probably true. You're probably like, are not going to go down the anti-vax rabbit hole. But like.
But that's not our predisposition anyway, to be fair, right? So.
But we've all had the experience of like, it's Friday at 8 p.m. and you like open YouTube and you like watch a video and then all of a sudden it's like 9:30. And you're like,
rabbit hole.
Where'd the evening go, right? And it's like, the evening went, there were 1,000 engineers behind that screen who have been trained basically on casino architecture that put bells and whistles on that screen to get you to waste your Friday night, right? That's a cost. Like this stuff is a giant waste of time, right? I mean, we all know that it also affects our ability to think and to concentrate. I know I don't remember things as much. I can't concentrate as much. And like-
Books are harder to read.
Yeah.
It's emotionally draining to like get into fights or not get into fights because the architecture kind of moves you in that direction. It's like if you were in a bar and there were a guy in the corner that was constantly egging people on to get into fights and he got paid whenever somebody got into a fight.
Right.
That's kind of the business model here. So it's not like he's forcing you to do things, but he's like making the world more unpleasant and also kind of encouraging people to go in that direction, knowing that some percentage will, and then he'll get paid on it. So it's like, this is a giant waste of time. It makes our lives worse.
And Matt, thanks so much for coming on, and you have to come back sometime.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, bye. Solar. Bye. This week's Substack only episode is an extended interview with Matt Stoller and a Stone Moment or Biden comedy packet submission. And guys, we want to encourage you to record your questions for us. Tweet out a video of yourself asking a question. You can use the hashtag #usefulidiotsquestion. We will collect them and watch some of them, play some of them, respond to some of them. And tag me and Matt. So I'm KT Halps, letter K, letter T, H-A-L-P-S. And Matt is M Taibbi, M-T-A-I-B-B-I. And also tag Useful Idiots Pod.
That was interesting. And yeah. We'll see you again next week.
Then please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.